Chapter 34. Alertness to Duty. So many students yield to the tempter and forget my warning voice. This bylaw is all that can save them on this important point. Mary Baker Eddy, 1899. Monday morning, June 5th, a correspondent for the London Daily Chronicle received a modest little card from Christian Science Headquarters in London, inviting him to attend a lecture that afternoon at Queen's Hall. Most of the publicity Christian Science had received in England heretofore had been notoriety the previous year, totally unjustified and largely untrue, concerning the death of the famed journalist, Harold Frederick. It was not the Frederick case, however, that aroused this man's interest and caused him to cancel a previous engagement. It was the description of the lecturer, William N. Miller, Esquire, QC, CSB. The newsman could recollect no English Queen's Counsel by that name and decided that in this case, the designation QC was as cryptic as were the letters CSB to him. But his curiosity was piqued. Expecting to find a few devoted adherents gathered on this sultry summer afternoon, he was surprised to find not one of the smaller halls, but the large hall at Queen's Hall, well filled. He was doubly surprised to find that the audience was one of the most fashionable of the season, apparently from the upper ranks of London society. After describing the audience, he went on to say, quote, "Moreover, a peer, Lord Dunmore, occupied the chair and introduced the lecturer," end quote. Perhaps by this time, the Chronicle representative was not surprised to learn that Mr. Miller was a distinguished lawyer and Queen's Counsel from Toronto, Canada, although he failed to understand why the audience did not cheer when Mr. Miller recounted his healing from deafness. While the London press was reporting on Lord Dunmore's activities that first week in June, the Boston press was accounting for Lord Dunmore's family. Sunday, June 4th, was Communion Day at the Mother Church, which had admitted the day before, at the first members' meeting, 2,469 new members from every state and territory in the United States, from Canada, Mexico, England, Scotland, Wales, France, Germany, Hungary, Russia, Norway, Australia, India, Hawaii, and the Bahamas. This communion service was considered the most important event since the dedication of the Mother Church more than 3 years earlier, and thousands had flocked to Boston to attend, necessitating four services throughout the day. Two pews in the gallery were set aside for press representatives, and one pew on the main floor was reserved. The reserved pew on the main floor was held for and occupied by the Countess of Dunmore, her son, Lord Fincastle, and her daughter, Lady Mildred Murray, who had come to America especially to be present at this annual communion. Lady Dunmore and her daughter came from England, and Lord Fincastle, who was a gallant young officer in the British Army, and who recently received the Victoria Cross in recognition of his services to his country, left his regiment in India to join his mother at this service. He will return to his duties immediately. The reservation of a pew for the Countess of Dunmore and her family was wholly a matter of international courtesy, and not in any sense a tribute to their rank. It was intended simply as a compliment to the country of which the party were distinguished representatives. It was evidently accepted in this sense, for when the church became crowded and the aisles were filled, Lord Fincastle and his sister, who is a young woman about 19 or 20 years of age, arose and surrendered their seats to 2 older women. They stood in the aisle during the remainder of the service. Another daughter who had remained in England was already an active Christian Science practitioner, and her brother had come from India expressly to join the Mother Church, which had caused Mrs. Eddy to write to the directors on May 30th. I request that under the present circumstances, you suspend the church bylaw and without the preliminaries, permit Lord and Lady Dunmore's son, Viscount Fincastle, to become a member of the Mother Church. The most important part of the communion service was an address from the leader, which was read by Mr. John W. Reeder. Passages that were underlined by students perusing the address after it appeared in the July Journal were: a lack of wisdom betrays truth into the hands of evil men as effectually as a subtle conspirator. The motive is not as wicked, but the result is as injurious. Return not evil for evil, but overcome evil with good. Then, whatever the shaft aimed at you or your practice may be, it will fall powerless, and God will reward your enemies according to their works. Watch and guard your own thoughts against evil suggestions. A lie left to itself is not so soon destroyed as it would be with the help of the truth-telling. Truth never falters nor fails. It is our faith that fails. The section that began, quote, "the doom of the Babylonish woman," referred to in Revelation, is being fulfilled, end quote, may have caused some of the Boston scientists to think of Mrs. Woodbury. But local and visiting scientists alike were more interested in an announcement from Judge Hanna at the 4th Sunday service. He stated that it would be best for those visitors who had arranged to go to Concord, New Hampshire, the home of Mrs. Eddy, to defer their visit until after Wednesday, the first hint that the leader might attend the annual meeting on Tuesday afternoon. On Monday afternoon, Mrs. Eddy, in company with several students, took the train from Concord to Boston. During the trip, when a gentleman on business entered the car, his eyes and Mrs. Eddy's met, and they recognized one another immediately, but he was hesitant to speak. Extending both hands and grasping his hands in hers, the leader said, "I am so glad to see you, dear. It is so many years since we met. Won't you sit down?" The man's eyes filled with tears, and Clara Shannon left her seat beside Mrs. Eddy so that they might converse. Sometime after he left, I went back to my seat, and Mother told me that he and his wife were her students, had been influenced against her, and turned away from the truth. She lost sight of them, and he had just told her that his wife passed on some years ago, and he had married again. He had often thought of her and remembered the truth that she had taught him, and he saw things then very differently. At 4:30 in the afternoon, a delegation met the train at the Boston Depot and accompanied Mrs. Eddy to her townhouse on Commonwealth Avenue, where she spent the night as a guest of the Hannahs, who resided there. That day and the next, she held many interviews with trustees, directors, editors, and several others, including Lady Dunmore and family. Tuesday, June 6th, was an historic occasion. The meeting was to be the largest the church had ever held. It was also the first general meeting of the church since October 1896. Though they knew it not at the time, it was Mrs. Eddy's last public appearance before her church in Boston. Even this appearance in a public place may have been to refute the numerous news reports that she was paralytic and even that she was dead. The directors had engaged Tremont Temple for the occasion in order to accommodate the thousands of members who had come to Boston from all corners of the globe. Tremont Temple was practically new, having been recently rebuilt after destruction by fire. But some in the audience remembered Mrs. Eddy's first appearance on that platform 14 years earlier, before a very hostile audience. When the meeting convened, most of those present did not know that Mrs. Eddy would be there, as she came unannounced, but all were hopeful. Judge Hanna, Calvin Fry, Clara Shannon, and James Neal accompanied her in her carriage, which arrived at the side entrance in order to avoid the throng, about 2:15. The leader's good health at 78 years of age, which was so much questioned in the press, was doubly apparent to those in her company when it became necessary to climb a long, narrow stairway to the stage entrance because the elevator was not running, with still another flight to the platform. The Boston Journal reported, "Up the platform steps she came, under the escort of Judge S. J. Hanna, and showing no signs of weariness or inability. She walked with as sprightly a step as a girl, and only by her white hair showed signs of age. Her eyes were very bright, and her face showed no mark of the rough hand of time. She was dressed in a rich gray silk dress, covered with black lace and jet trimming. Her hat was a small but tasteful gray, which was very becoming." The newly elected president of the Mother Church, William P. McKenzie, had begun his speech and had not yet reached the key sentence, "And now the time is coming for us to understand that as the bird must learn to use his wings and must find his home in the whole heavens, so we must rise out of the limits of organization, out of that which is limited and temporal, into a higher glory of life." When someone behind him on the stage touched his arm, and the audience began looking around expectantly, then all rose to their feet and began applauding with something deeper than noisy enthusiasm. After Mrs. Eddy had been seated, Judge Hanna stepped forward and said, "Beloved friends, whatever the disappointment we may have felt because of the absence of our leader and mother from our communion service, is more than compensated for by the fact that she is now here. You all know her, and you all love her. She knows you all and loves you all. And perhaps it will not be amiss for me to remark, by way of parentheses, that she is in the enjoyment of excellent health. Laughter and applause. I regret to say, so far as I am personally concerned, that she is here rather to hear than to be heard. Nevertheless, possibly we may hear from her before the meeting closes. I hope so, and yet I have no authority to say so. Now will the audience join in singing, "Shepherd, Show Me How to Go." Following the hymn, plus the communion hymn, "Saw Ye My Savior," the treasurer's report was read. Then Mr. McKenzie stepped forward and introduced Mrs. Eddy, who addressed the audience briefly. Miscellany, page 131. The bitter waters of Meribah, she mentioned, meant little to her happy children on that joyous occasion. At the conclusion of her remarks, as she left the platform, they rose and joined in singing the doxology. The mother retired for a short time to a suite at the Parker House, where she received several friends before departing for the station. The press coverage of her visit to Boston was extensive. All the Boston papers reported it with words somewhat similar to these from the Morning Herald. The appearance of Mrs. Eddy at the annual meeting, her reception at her Commonwealth Avenue home, and her return journey to New Hampshire, all within 24 hours, furnished convincing proof of the fact that she is in the enjoyment of excellent health. The return journey to Concord was in a private railway car, where an amusing and touching incident occurred. The Negro porter beamed as if he felt something marvelous was happening to him in meeting this wonderful woman. Mrs. Eddy smiled sweetly, asked his name, and told him she had lived in the South and had known an elderly Negro by the same name. She told Clara Shannon that she wanted to give the porter some money and to go ask Calvin if he had any. She added what Clara got from Calvin to what she had in the purse in her pocket, and according to Miss Shannon, she then rang for the porter and told him to hold out his hands open and place them together and to close his eyes, and she poured her money into those palms and spoke to him about God's love. One seldom sees such a happy, joyful, and surprised face as his at receiving such a harvest. A little later, when they ate the delicious supper provided by the Hannahs, Mrs. Eddy requested that they be sure that the porter receive a hearty portion. The next day, reporters from all the papers were once again at Tremont Temple. There were far too many visiting scientists to be accommodated in the Mother Church, but the reporters were surprised that the meeting was called simply Wednesday Evening Meeting. The Boston Post reported, "Tremont Temple has been the scene of many remarkable gatherings. Within its walls, men of nearly all faiths or phases of belief have met and given hearty assent to the proclamation of their creed, Yet never in the history of the revered hall has there ever been a more remarkable demonstration than that of last evening, when the Christian Scientists met to give testimony of their belief. Following the preliminary exercises, people from all over the country testified to having been healed of all manner of disease, of cancer, consumption, paralysis, spinal meningitis, dyspepsia, typhoid fever, scarlet fever, alcoholism, etc., etc. Many had exhausted the physician's skill and were at death's door. The testimonials could have continued all night, but after an hour and a half, Judge Hanna said, "I would be glad to extend this meeting, but I think the time has arrived when we should bring it to a close." Before closing, however, I will ask those present who know of a certainty that they have been healed through Christian Science to please rise. According to the Boston Herald, quote, "Almost everyone on the main floor, in the two galleries, on the platform, and in the choir gallery, promptly stood up." End quote. Several other questions met a like response. Questions intended to refute the false charges of pulpit and press regarding believing in God, believing in prayer, and the power of prayer. When he asked, quote, "How many are there here, Christian Scientists, who believe in Jesus Christ absolutely and unqualifiedly?" End quote. The reporter stated that not more than a dozen among the thousands remained seated, and perhaps 300 throughout the house stood as those who knew they had been healed simply by reading Science and Health. This finale was impressive. Before opening the meeting to the audience, Judge Hanna had spoken a word about the leader's presence the day before, adding, quote, "I might also remark here that, strange as it may seem to some, although she arrived in Boston during the business hours of Monday and remained in Boston all day yesterday, she was not arrested," end quote. This met with laughter and applause, but it really was not a laughing matter. Another malicious attack from Mrs. Woodbury's poisoned pen was that Mrs. Eddy had sought to refuge in New Hampshire because she had issued illegal certificates as the president of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College and dared not appear in Boston on weekdays for fear of arrest. And ridiculous as this claim was, the press had given it circulation. This first week in June saw days of triumph for the Christian Scientists, but the imp of darkness was trotting right alongside. A sensational article appeared in the Chicago Inter-Ocean of Sunday, June 18th. Although totally untrue, it stated that Chicago Christian Scientists were seriously in doubt as to whether Mrs. Eddy was really alive and on earth, that she had been dead for years, that she did not appear at any of the recent meetings in Boston, and that her address at the annual meeting had been read by another person. Mr. Forrest P. Hull, a reporter for the Boston Journal, was handed the report from the Chicago paper on Tuesday afternoon and immediately went to Judge Hanna, who authorized and assisted with an emphatic refutation, which was printed Tuesday afternoon. But the journal wanted more. So Mr. Hall left for Concord. It was late Tuesday night when he arrived at Pleasant View unannounced, and Mr. Fry thought it impossible for him to see Mrs. Eddy. But unexpectedly, the leader granted him an interview about 9:30 p.m. The following, with a Concord station dateline, was abstracted from the next day's Boston Journal. Quote, "Am I alive? Why, I haven't felt more sound for 40 years." End quote. These are words which will set at rest once and for all the reports which come out of the West with resistless regularity that Mrs. Mary Baker Eddy is dead and has been in the grave for several years. It was the forcible and picturesque response to the question of a Boston Journal man as Mrs. Eddy tripped lightly into the parlor of her beautiful home in the city last night at an hour when many younger persons are in bed. It was the real Mrs. Eddy and nobody else with whom the journalman talked for half an hour. The same Mrs. Eddy whom the reporter saw alight from her carriage in front of Tremont Temple 2 weeks ago, as Mrs. Eddy came down the front stairs with the agility of a maiden and tripped lightly across the parlor floor, the reporter's eyes bulged as he thought of a woman of 80 who has worked hard and thought deeply all her life. She was charmingly dressed in black satin, black waist with purple front. Her snow-white hair, combed gracefully from the middle of her head, was held by side combs studded with brilliance. Her complexion, like pink satin, clear and unflecked by furrow or wrinkle, and her eyes bright and glistening, were no uncertain evidence of health and contentment. "It is only an impulse that I talk with you tonight," she said. "I see no reporters, and as my time is so thoroughly taken up by my work, it is not possible for me to entertain callers. I came to Concord for seclusion. Yes, it was way back in the 70s that the reports were first given out that I was dead. But here I am, and in good health. During the 10 years that I have been here, I think I have missed but 3 days for my daily drives. I go out summer and winter, rain or shine. There were 2 days last winter when the streets were almost impassable during that most severe cold weather that I did not go out driving, and one other time in years past that I could not go out. But for 10 years, I have missed but 3 days. One day last winter, when the wind blew frightfully, I drove about the city. Coming home, it seemed as if the carriage would be blown away from the street, and the driver expected it. But we arrived home safely, and I felt no bad effects from the experience. What are your working hours?" "I arise at 6 o'clock in the morning," replied Mrs. Eddy, "and work all day. I retire to my room at 9 o'clock, but not always to sleep. Today, I have answered about 20 letters. I take 10 minutes for every letter of 4 pages, read it thoroughly, consider it, and then write or dictate the answer to my private secretary. Of course, there are hundreds of letters that I never answer at all. Today, I have entertained letters from Congo Free State, from several European countries, and answered a letter from the wife of our minister in China. Your time is occupied in other ways.
Yes, from all over the country. I am besieged with requests for messages and counsel.
Whenever a new church is opened, the people think I ought to mail some new words of cheer and comfort if I cannot attend. So all these things take my time. I cannot go to Boston. I have not the time, for there is much that requires my attention here every hour of the day. During the recent convention, I felt that it was a call from God to speak to our dear people. I was there all day, and after running up and down stairs, holding receptions, and speaking words of cheer here and there, I rode back at night. There was a couch in my car, but I did not lie down. I did not feel tired, although it was a pretty good day's work. I suppose the fact that you are to a great extent inaccessible to those who wish to call on you gives rise to many of these rumors of your death.
Yes, replied Mrs. Eddy. I reluctantly turn away many more from my door than I see. It is impossible for me to entertain the hosts who wish to see me. For years I have been trying to discourage hero worship. Here is an incident. It was the first time that I have uttered a reproof to anybody on such an occasion. Many people were tarrying at my gate when I got ready to take a drive one day after the recent convention. They had come from all parts of the country. I stopped my carriage at the gate and spoke to these people. Then I drove away. But when I came back, one woman remained there 2 hours waiting for me to return. I stopped and said, "What are you here for?"
"For spiritual help," she replied.
"Have you no God?"
"Yes," she said. "Then never come here again to see me. Depend on yourself. Go into your closet and pray that He may guide and counsel you."
"You leave home but rarely now, do you not?"
"Yes, I am trying to extend this idea of God help instead of my help on all my people. My heart is with them all, but they cannot expect that I can leave my work that is somewhat apart from theirs." Age has descended lightly on you, despite your years of thought and toil, remarked the journalman.
I never boast of my health or speak of the tomorrow, but when I was driving recently, I was stopped by one who, after inquiring about my health, remarked, "Mrs. Eddy, you look to be about 40 years old." Farther than this, I do not know what people think, but I really do not feel older than 40 years. As I toil on, I am comforted by the scriptures. Ye shall run and not weary. Walk and not faint. The reporter was naive in his supposition that Mrs. Eddy's inaccessibility gave rise to the rumors of her death. He may have assumed that she agreed with him, but she did not. She said, "Yes, I turn many away." When Chicago students traced, quote, "the reports which come out of the West with resistless regularity," end quote, they found that they repeatedly led back to Josephine Woodbury. But other detractors joined in and added to these malicious falsities. A Boston clergyman, Charles A. Crane, gave an address in a church in Chelsea, which was a melodramatic tirade against Mrs. Eddy. In total misapprehension of spiritual mind reading, or Mrs. Eddy's, quote, first sight, end quote, he claimed he had good authority for stating that within 3 years she had taken the decoctions of a clairvoyant doctor. In answer to this lie, she had Hannah delete her letter regarding first sight from page 16 of his Christian Science History and replace it with this paragraph. In justice to myself and the readers of your booklet, I send a brief explanation of my writings that appeared in your first editions and has been quoted by a clergyman and ignorantly or intentionally misconstrued. The spiritual sense referred to therein is this discerning of the purpose of a mental malpractitioner whose thoughts turn on me with evil intent. This spiritual discernment is neither universal nor indiscriminate mind reading. It is a consciousness wherewith good is done and no evil can be done. This phenomena appeared in my childhood, is associated with my earliest memories, and has increased with my spiritual increase. It has aided me in healing the sick and subordinating the human to the divine. While this metaphysical phenomena puzzles poor philosophy and is not in the slightest degree theosophy, hypnotism, clairvoyance, or an element of the human mind, I regard it as a component part of the science of mind, not yet understood. Wednesday, June 21st, was the day Mr. Hull's interview with Mrs. Eddy appeared in the Boston Journal, and it was also the day of a most unusual Wednesday evening meeting at the Mother Church. Instead of opening the second portion of the meeting to the congregation, Judge Hannah read a lengthy statement in refutation of the recent attacks on Mrs. Eddy, and particularly of that of Mr. Crane. One paragraph stated, "As to Mr. Crane's specific charge, all know who are well enough acquainted with her to be able to speak intelligently, that Mrs. Eddy has not taken a drop of any kind of medicine since she began her labor in Christian Science, that she has not employed physicians of any kind, that God has been her only physician since her awakening to the great fact that He is the only true healer, and to this she will testify anywhere and at any time." The rest of the meeting was devoted to refuting the lies that Mrs. Eddy was dead or physically incapacitated. The journal reporter spoke and told of his recent interview at Pleasant View, and also of previous occasions when he had seen Mrs. Eddy. Then Mr. Henry D. Nunn read affidavits and signed statements from several newsmen who had seen Mrs. Eddy at Tremont Temple and who knew something about her. Albert Metcalf and William B. Johnson both spoke before Hannah closed the meeting. 5 pages of the next week's Sentinel were devoted to reporting this meeting to the field. The following Saturday, June 24th, Mrs. Eddy wrote to the directors with a postscript to the clerk. "My beloved students, at last I am driven to protect myself with a bylaw in order to save our cause from a new means of destroying it by disgracing Christian Scientists. Once, when I referred to a mistake made by a student, he would see it and kindly apologize. Now he or she does not see it even after again and again being reminded of it. Hence, he does not excuse it. This sad fact indicates a certain downfall for this church. In a quarter of a century, I have never seen one failure in this sign. 3 years almost, I have had no rest from defending our church and cause from the blows of two students. But now, instead of exposing them, and W especially, I am the one you refer to before the public in a matter that foreigners deem disrespect to leaders, and such it will appear, although I know it is not intended for that. With love, Mary Baker Eddy. My dear student, read this letter in public meeting, and please say to Mr. Nunn that I thank him for his kind article in reference to me, published in the Boston paper. It is best to have this bylaw, but do not publish it in our periodicals. Put it in the manual. So many students yield to the tempter and forget my warning voice. This bylaw is all that can save them on this important point. When another comes up, then we must have another bylaw. Alas, for the sleepers and for me. How often the students did not understand the leader, her actions, or the important point to be met at the moment. The resignation of Hannah, as well as of Neil from the publishing committee, may or may not have been at Mrs. Eddy's request. Whatever the reason for the resignations, the clerk wrote to the mother on June 27th. The directors have elected Reverend Irving C. Tomlinson and Mr. Henry D. Nunn, members of the publishing committee, in the places of Judge Hannah and Mr. James A. Neal, resigned subject to your approval. The mother's answer read, "You have my approval. Moreover, also, please say in your public meeting that I say a vote of thanks and my name with others expressing gratitude for his noble service on committee and in all his important offices. Richly belongs to him." Her students were doing the best they knew, and she was grateful. But their work was not striking at the root of the wickedness which was being sown broadcast. Quote, "Alas for the sleepers and for me," end quote. The bylaw designed to save the sleepers was alertness to duty. It shall be the duty of every member of this church to daily so defend himself against aggressive mental suggestion as not to be made to forget nor to neglect his duty to God, to his leader, and to mankind. By his works he shall be judged and justified or condemned.